This is gonna sound weird, but bear with me. When I was in high school, there was a kid who told everyone he was a demon. I don't feel comfortable even writing his name for reasons you'll soon understand. I'm just gonna call him Patrick, even though his name sounds like something out of a Shakespeare play. He was extremely socially awkward, and walked around with a super empty stare that made even teachers uncomfortable. He wore the same blank gray hoodie literally every single day. I'm not exaggerating. I'm pretty sure he never washed the thing, since he always smelled terrible too. He was decently short and pretty average looking, although you wouldn't be able to tell since he always had his hood up. He never took his sunglasses off, even inside. Teachers eventually stopped asking him to because he would never listen anyway. Now comes the weird stuff. He didn't have any friends, but had this weird tendency to adopt people. What I mean by that is, if he liked you, which he could decide randomly one day, he would walk up to you and say, "You're adopted," meaning you were part of his circle or whatever. Apparently, this would make you safe from him or something. That's at least what he'd say about it. He didn't really like that many people, though, so few people were ever really adopted. I was one of those few. Looking back, it was probably because he had a crush on me. None of us believed his demon spiel, and everyone just assumed he was a troubled kid, which he definitely was. Oh yeah, I should probably mention that this all takes place in Wayne, Pennsylvania, which is where I grew up. Another girl I used to be friends with, Gabby, had also been adopted by him. Patrick's crush on her was a little more obvious, and all my friends knew it. One day, my friends and I were chilling on the dugouts behind our high school, killing time and doing God knows what. It was me, Gabby, Laura, and Luke. I can't exactly remember how it happened, but the topic of conversation floated over to Patrick's crush on Gabby. We were all laughing about it, and Gabby was pretty obviously embarrassed. I can't remember what it was, but there was a nickname we'd substitute for Patrick's name, because his real name was too clunky. This time though, I distinctly remember Laura using Patrick's real name. The third time she said it, I swear in my life that Patrick appeared out of nowhere and jumped on top of the dugout with a baseball bat in his hand. It wasn't scary in a typical sense, but it was one of the most unsettling things I'd ever seen up until that point. We quickly stopped talking, nervous that he might have overheard us talking about him. He didn't say anything though, and just stared at us. I gave him a little wave, and he nodded in acknowledgement at me before jumping back down to the ground and swiftly walking away. After we were sure he was gone, the four of us burst into laughter, finding humor in how weird the whole encounter was. On the inside though, I was still a little disturbed. The next incident I can remember was significantly more creepy and impossible to laugh about. I was literally in Laura's house, and the two of us were hanging out in her room. Her parents were home. I'm not sure what exactly we were talking about, but again, Patrick's name was said three times between the two of us. Not 10 minutes later, we heard Laura's front door slam shut. Confused, we went downstairs to see if one of our other friends had decided to pull up. Laura was friends with everyone, and her parents were super chill, so people came and went unannounced when it came to her house. Laura's mom had beaten us to the door, though. We turned the corner of the living room and stared in shock at Patrick, who was just standing there, talking to Laura's mom. She asked him what he was doing there, to which he literally replied, "I was summoned." Laura's mom made some small talk with him before politely asking him to leave, which he silently did. The reason why more alarm bells weren't going off was because Laura's mom actually knew Patrick and pitied him. Laura and I weren't as calm about the situation, though. As we walked back up the stairs, we talked to each other with horrified faces about how creepy that was. A few minutes later, we made the connection between the two events. He seemed to pop up when his name was uttered three times. I know how ridiculous this sounds, but we had both witnessed two unexplainable events and knew Patrick's history of claiming to be a demon. How else could someone else rationalize what had taken place? We told all of our friends about the incident the next day, and our friend group swore to never say his name three times in one conversation again. Things were going well for a few months, and I started to think that maybe I had overreacted. That is, until one day, when my same group of friends were hanging out at my other friend Johnny's house. We were chilling on his back deck when the topic of conversation again found itself concerning Patrick. Despite all of our efforts to convince him, Johnny refused to believe what we told him about Patrick. Even after confirming the story with the entire group, he was still skeptical. To display his disbelief, he jokingly used Patrick's name 3 times in the same sentence, to our dismay. When nothing happened, he grinned and told us we were stupid to believe something so ridiculous. As annoyed as I was, part of me was relieved that he hadn't shown up. I spoke too soon, though, because a few minutes later, Patrick jumped over Johnny's backyard fence. Johnny noticed him first and stopped speaking mid-sentence. The rest of us followed suit and went dead silent, nervous about what Patrick might do this time. We watched as he stared at us for a few seconds before jumping back over the fence and disappearing out of sight. Johnny started freaking out and accused us of conspiring with Patrick to scare him. We told him that we literally begged him not to say anything. We sat in silence for a while before Johnny eventually told us all to go home, clearly shaken from the experience. The last experience I had concerning Patrick was definitely the scariest and most disturbing. It was the only one where I felt like my life might have actually been in danger. A few months after the incident at Johnny's house, I was home alone one night. My parents rarely left the house back then, so this was a rare occurrence. I decided to take advantage of the situation and invited a boy over whom I'd been talking to. He was kind of a tool, but so were most of the guys I was talking to at that age. We were hanging out in my room, and it was lightly raining outside. After a while, he mentioned something about Patrick, which made me visibly cringe. He got confused, so I explained the situation to him. He burst out laughing and told me he was gonna say Patrick's name to scare me. I begged him not to, but he did it anyway. Only this time, he didn't just say it. He literally screamed Patrick's name 3 times at the top of his lungs. There was no delay this time. The moment he finished yelling, I could hear the rain instantly pick up outside. A few seconds later, there was a flash of lightning. I started to freak out. The guy I was with actually seemed sorry and told me it was probably just an extremely unlikely coincidence. I cursed him out and ran to my window to look at the storm. I glanced down to look at my driveway and screamed when I saw a silhouette of a person looking up at my window. It was too dark and stormy to know for sure, but I was 99% certain that it was Patrick. I shut the blinds and rushed downstairs to make sure all the doors were locked. After locking the back door, I saw that person again. Only this time, he was standing motionlessly in my front yard. I felt a panic attack coming on, and I knew Patrick was going to find a way inside my house. I started screaming, "But I'm adopted," over and over again, hoping that would do something. I know there was no way he'd have been able to hear me, but my brain was all over the place at that point. The guy I was with ran down the stairs a few seconds later and picked me up off the kitchen floor in an attempt to comfort me. I looked out the window again, and he was gone. The storm was still coming down like crazy, though, but it's not like I was going to search the property anyway. The next morning, after that guy had left, I went out to inspect my yard. To my horror, I found something sinister in the far corner of my backyard. It was Patrick's hoodie, and wrapped inside of it were a couple random belongings of mine that I assumed I lost. My parents were gone another day, and I was too scared to call the police. I figured I'd show my parents what I had found after school the next day, and they'd take it from there. I never had to, though. The next day, Patrick didn't show up to school. He didn't show up the day after that either. None of us ever saw him again, and no one knew what happened to him. My parents still live in the same house, which is something I think about a lot. I know this isn't your typical scary story, but I'm not sure where else to vent about this. A few people from school told me they caught Patrick hiding and eavesdropping on their conversations, which could explain how he was able to show up out of nowhere. As I've grown older and thought back on the whole thing, I think what makes the most sense is Patrick was just a mentally ill stalker who followed me and possibly other girls around, hence why he was always able to appear when his name was brought up. It skeeves me out just imagining him following me around all over the place, listening to me. I don't even want to wonder where he is today. I'm from Denver. This happened a few years ago. My friend Mike and I were heading to a dinner party one snowy Saturday evening. We decided to stop at a liquor store before heading to the party. It was honestly a pretty annoying detour with the snow coming down, but we didn't want to show up completely empty-handed. We picked out some local craft beers and a bottle of whiskey and made our way back to the car. I remember the snow started to pick up around then, but it was nothing we weren't used to. He ran back into the liquor store to grab a pack of Zyns, his latest nicotine fixation. I remember being annoyed about that because I was the one driving and didn't have the best car for the snow at the time. After a few minutes, he emerged from the liquor store and hopped in the car. I immediately pulled out of the parking lot and we were back on our way. The snow was falling even heavier now, covering the roads in a thick blanket of white. The drive to the party was supposed to be straightforward, about 20 to 30 minutes through familiar suburban neighborhoods. Things in my life are never as easy as they seem, though. The snowstorm had other plans, turning what was supposed to be a relaxing route into a treacherous journey. Let me just say, I'm not a great driver as is, and the car slipping every 10 seconds didn't help matters. After a tense few minutes driving uphill, I turned a corner and was met with a sight no one ever wants to see. In the middle of the street was a stopped car. Its hazards were flashing ominously, cutting through the falling snow like distress signals. Both the driver's and passenger side doors were open. I was tempted to just drive around it and continue on my merry way, but Mike instructed me to stop. Judge me if you want, but I'm not your typical Good Samaritan. I've been through way too much BS in my life that has ultimately resulted in a distrust in strangers I typically default to. I told him we were late, but he urged me to stop with a concerned voice. Mike had gotten me into trouble before with his childlike curiosity, but this was different. Someone could be in trouble. Reluctantly, I stopped the car, and the two of us sat in emotionless silence for a few seconds. Mike asked if we should check it out, which I told him was what we were doing. He rolled his eyes and told me watching the car from through the windshield wasn't going to accomplish anything. He was kind of right. I really didn't want to get out of the car, though. Nervous about the situation, I asked him if he'd just wait a few more minutes, which he reluctantly agreed to. We sat there watching the eerie blinking of the hazards against what was otherwise a beautiful snowy backdrop. Nothing happened, which I was kind of surprised by. Eventually, Mike said he had had enough and was going to investigate. Before I could stop him, he stepped out of the car. I watched with a rising sense of apprehension as he approached the vehicle. As he was doing so, I could have sworn I saw something dark move out of the corner of my eye. It might have been my worried mind playing tricks on me, but this situation was seeming worse and worse to me every second that passed. Not even 10 seconds later, I thought I saw the car jolt a little, like something had moved in the trunk or back seat. Again, maybe my mind was playing tricks on me, but I didn't care. I made a quick time decision and slammed on the horn, startling Mike, who had been inspecting the inside of the vehicle. He understood what I was communicating and sprinted back to the car. I drove off immediately and told him my suspicion that the whole thing was a trap. He was pretty annoyed when I told him I didn't have any actual proof, but I responded in a firm voice that I wasn't going to risk my life for someone who could easily call for help. The rest of the drive was pretty tense, to be completely honest. He was the type of guy to hold a grudge longer than most. We arrived at the dinner party and things were finally normal again. We were there for several hours, and Mike and I had all but forgotten what happened earlier. After a nice dinner and an enjoyable time catching up with old friends, our host turned on the TV to give some departing guests an update on the snowstorm. He flicked over to the local news, and what I saw was actually horrifying. The police were issuing reports of a stolen vehicle that had been jacked not even 2 hours earlier. They were circulating a spoken account from the victim, which went something like this. A woman was driving her teenage son home from a friend's house when she noticed a car in the middle of the road, hazards on and doors open. The two approached the car to see if someone was in distress, and as they did, two men sprung out from behind a snowbank and another emerged from the trunk of the vehicle. They held the woman at gunpoint and forced her to turn over her keys. They promptly sped off with the stolen car, along with the one that had been used in the trap. I stared at Mike with a look of pure fear. That could have been us. The two of us told the rest of the party what happened earlier, and that quickly put a damper on the general atmosphere, but people were eating the story up. The worst thing about this experience is that I'm even more distrusting of strangers than I previously was. I often think about how many people I would have otherwise helped out in a time of need had I not experienced such a meticulous trap. The series of events I'm about to recount happened over 30 years ago, during my early childhood. Forgive me if some details are shaky, but I'll try to remember as much as possible. I was around 10 years old. My extended family was massive. At that age, it was hard for me to remember the faces of all my relatives, let alone their names. At every family gathering, I was introduced to someone whose face I didn't recognize, even though they all seemed to recognize me. My dad was one of nine children, so I had eight sets of aunts and uncles on his side alone. My grandparents on my dad's side were extremely well off and had a massive beachfront property, which was communal along my dad and his siblings. I don't know its exact dimensions, but I'm pretty sure I could sleep over 30 people. Because of this, my family would often spend entire chunks of the summer down there. Both my parents had jobs that allowed them to either work remotely or spend a lot of time away from their offices. My dad's siblings and their kids would do the same. There was rarely a time when it was just our family at the beach house. I got along with all my cousins and preferred spending time at the beach house rather than at home since I was closer with some of my cousins than any of my hometown friends. I liked a lot of my aunts and uncles too. My favorite by far was Uncle Joseph, who was the father of my cousin Brandon. Brandon was honestly kind of antisocial and we didn't really play that much together. Uncle Joseph was awesome though, and he'd never fail to brighten my mood or make me laugh. In addition to being great with kids, he was a licensed therapist and psychiatrist, and was often who I'd turn to in times of need. There's a decent chance he knew more about me than my parents did. I confided in him regularly, and there was nothing I was uncomfortable divulging. Anyway, that summer, I began having tremendously graphic and disturbing nightmares. As far as I can recall, there weren't any common themes between them. They'd all just be about something psychologically taxing, like a family member dying or being alone forever, or something along those lines. I wish I could provide more details, but I've long since purged my mind of those horrors. I do remember one dream distinctly, though. It was one of those false awakening dreams. I woke up and went downstairs to meet my parents for breakfast, like I do on a typical morning. When I got downstairs, though, they weren't in the kitchen, and there was no food on the dining room table. I ran back upstairs and barged into my parents' and then siblings' rooms, but no one was there. The rest of the dream was basically me crying on my bedroom floor, wondering why everyone had abandoned me. After three or four of those nightmares in a row, I decided to tell my Uncle Joseph out of embarrassment of telling my parents. He listened with a concerned look on his face as I described the kinds of things I was experiencing, and he even started writing things down in his little notebook. He instructed me to do some meaningful internal self-reflection as something was clawing at my subconscious. What kind of self-reflection was I supposed to do, though? I was 10 years old. He told me he'd mull things over, and that I should come back to him if the problem persisted. Of course, it did. A few days and nightmares later, I gave Uncle Joseph an update. He told me he'd been thinking about the situation, and that he had figured out what was going on in my brain. He said that even though I didn't think it, I was deeply frustrated with my parents and was harboring some unresolved resentment towards them. I was more confused than I've ever been. I was nothing if not a well-behaved, polite, grateful kid. I had always listened to my parents and loved them more than anything. Uncle Joseph knew what he was talking about, though. He was a therapist, after all. I assumed he had dealt with similar situations in the past and considered myself lucky that he was helping me. I asked him how I should proceed with everything, and told him this newfound knowledge kind of scared me. He told me it was perfectly normal that I was scared, and that most of his adult patients react in the same way. He then told me it was also normal that I disagreed with what he was saying, since dreaming implies a subconscious feeling that the brain refuses to accept. That did kind of make sense to me. He told me that in the next few days, I should be slightly more disobedient when it came to my parents. He told me to try saying no more often, and to argue with them when I didn't get my way. So that's what I did. For 3 days after talking to him, I behaved so uncharacteristically that my parents got concerned. They told me they didn't like my recent behavior, and I'd better quit it. It killed me to do that to them, but I couldn't stand having nightmares literally every night. My 10-year-old self would have done anything to put an end to those night terrors. They didn't stop, though. In fact, they actually got worse. More graphic, more disturbing, and more vivid. It was too much. I confided in Uncle Joseph again, and he told me there was one more thing we could try. I begged him to tell me what it was, but he seemed hesitant. After a few minutes of pleading, he revealed what the thing was. He said my brain was too mature for my young body and that I needed to set it free. Obviously, I had no idea what he meant by that. He told me if I had one more nightmare, he'd tell me what I had to do. I went to sleep, terrified that night. I didn't want to set my body free, even if I didn't know what he was talking about. That night, I actually woke up before having a nightmare. In the several days that this had been going on, I had never woken up before having a nightmare. This was new. For some reason, though, I was scared to move or even breathe loudly. It wasn't sleep paralysis, but I was scared out of my mind. I stared at the wall in that same position for a full minute, not quite sure what I was doing. The next thing I heard was something I will never forget, no matter how hard I try. Whispering, right next to my ear. Uncle Joseph's whispering. I was sure of it. I turned over and screamed, which sent him flying back. He quickly left the room and shut the door. I sat there in a cold sweat. Part of me thought I was still having a nightmare. Instead of going back to sleep, I ran to my parents' room and told them everything. I told them about the nightmares, about Uncle Joseph, about everything. My dad didn't waste a second. He stormed into Uncle Joseph's room and confronted him. My uncle obviously denied everything, but my dad was a big dude and could easily push him around. A fight broke out between them, and my dad snatched the satchel Uncle Joe carried everywhere. Uncle Joseph promptly gathered up his things and basically ran to his car. My dad started going through the satchel, and what he found was sickening. There were pages and pages of dream-related things, both handwritten notes and printed articles. Articles about inducing dreams, specifically nightmares. Personal notes about different techniques, previous data, and types of experiments. It was horrific. Uncle Joseph was eventually arrested, as the police found some even more suggestive things on his computer. I'm not going to go into full detail, but I'm sure you could piece together what they found based on Uncle Joseph wanting to set my body free. I never saw him again. I don't know what happened to him long term, since my parents never liked talking about the situation, at least around me. Sometimes I kick myself for being so naive about the whole thing, but there's nothing I can do about that now.